Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Haudenosaunee and the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. I'm speaking with Dr. Patricia Corcoran, Associate Professor and Department Chair at University of Western Ontario. And today we're going to talk about something that I've never heard about before, plastigomerate. So welcome to Earth Matters, Patricia, and tell us a bit about yourself, how you got involved in the study of plastics and sedimentary petrology, microplastics, etc., and what is your current line of investigation?
Oh, okay. Thank you, Lawson. I am a sedimentary petrologist in the Department of Earth Sciences at Western University, and I've been here for the last 17 years. I started out studying sedimentary deposits that are very old. We're talking about 2 to 3 billion years old. But I also study very young sedimentary deposits. So any kinds of grains that you find, for example, on beaches today. And so not only do I study natural sedimentary grains, but I also study anthropogenic grains, meaning grains that you find on the beach or on land or in the water that are formed by humans. So not necessarily natural in their state, but they behave in a certain way that is very similar to natural sedimentary grains in the environment. And plastic is obviously one of those types of grains. It's anthropogenic. It's formed from human activity, originally from the petroleum industry. And so what we end up with is we have these human-made materials that are infiltrating our natural ecosystems on Earth. And I started studying plastic when I went to Hawaii. I had a research grant to study natural grains, so heavy minerals in sediment. And when I was there, I noticed that there was an abundance of plastic debris along the shorelines of Hawaii. So I started out by having a master's student study the distribution of that plastic debris along the Hawaiian Islands. And that led to a colleague actually giving me an envelope with plastic pellets in it and saying that he had found that on a beach near Goderich. And so that naturally led me to think that there is plastic pollution in the Great Lakes of North America. So that's sort of where we've been focusing most of our work, is in the Great Lakes region. We are looking along shorelines, but now mostly what we are doing is looking at microplastics, so plastic that is less than 5 millimeters in size, that we find in benthic sediment, so on the lake bottoms, but also in the bottoms of rivers. And we're still looking at some microplastics in surface waters. So we concentrate on the Great Lakes, but I also have projects that deal with benthic sediment in the Arctic as well. And of course, we're always going back to Hawaii to see if we can find more of this plastiglomerate, which we identified in 2014 on Kamilo Beach on the Big Island of Hawaii.
I want to talk about the microplastics, and of course, anyone that's walked along a beach anywhere sees the garbage and debris and the leftover, you know, waste that we just sort of throw away and ends up on the shoreline. But my first question is, do you consider yourself a geologist, a biologist, an anthropologist? Where do you fit in?
So I'm actually a geologist by training, but I like to consider myself also an environmental geoscientist.
Okay, all right. you mentioned the fact that, you're walking along what's considered the pristine beaches of Hawaii, and much to your amazement, there's plastic pollution there. And then, the colleague that gave you the plastic from the Great Lakes, was that a shock to you? Because in our mind, when we think about plastics and the giant gear in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, that's our image of plastics ending up in the oceans. We constantly hear about every time we throw away a plastic bag, it'll end up in the ocean. But is this a new revelation? Is this something new that we're finding so much garbage on our Great Lakes shores?
I wouldn't say that it's new. When I had received that envelope, that was back in about 2009. So at that time, it was surprising because you're correct. But when we think of plastic, most of what's been publicized is what we find out in the oceans or along the shorelines of oceans. So at that time, I was surprised. I'm not surprised anymore. So we've been working there for a decade, and there are microplastics and large plastic items as well on shorelines on every Great Lake. And if I go back to those plastic pellets that my colleague sent to me, we're actually involved in a project right now in which, over a 2-week period, there were 12 of us who went around all of the Great Lakes shoreline, and we actually sampled 66 beaches and found pellets all over in all of those locations. So I'm not surprised. There are other publications out there about microplastics and macroplastic debris in freshwater environments all over the world. So it's not just in the Great Lakes.
Looking at the Great Lakes specifically, is there an area or a lake that is worse than others, or a certain shoreline or a certain specific area?
Well, thus far, we've focused on Lake Erie, Ontario, Huron, and St. Clair. So we haven't really looked at Michigan or Superior in great detail. But thus far, in terms of plastic debris items that we find on beaches, so the pellets, for example, the two main hotspots or sinks are the Sarnia area on Lake Huron and Oakville area near Toronto. And in terms of microplastics, the same thing applies, is that we're finding a lot of those very, very tiny plastic items in benthic sediment in Lake Ontario mainly, so in the Toronto Harbour area. One of our samples from Etobicoke Creek contained roughly 28,000 microplastic particles per kilogram of dry weight sediment. So that's kind of equivalent to a bag of sugar. So if you can imagine, you have a bag of sugar and there are 28,000 microplastic particles in that bag of sugar.
Okay, so Sarnia and Toronto are on the Canadian side of the Great Lakes. What about the US side of the Great Lakes?
So this is interesting. I get that question a lot. And the U.S. side of the Great Lakes, it just depends. So Lake Erie in general tends to be, when I'm looking at sediment, tends to be cleaner. I say that in quotation marks, but cleaner than the other Great Lakes. And that includes on the American side. Lake Huron, most of the plastic debris we are finding is on the Canadian side, not the American side. This doesn't mean that Americans are not polluting. What it means is a lot of this material goes into the lakes, and then we have surface water currents that are circulating that material around, and a lot of it is buoyant, so it's floating and it moves with the currents. It also moves with storm events, and so it's not as simple as, Canadians are polluting and the materials going into the lake right in front of where we're polluting, because it's always being moved around. So it's not a simple answer to say that, one side is cleaner than the other side. There are reasons for that.
Let's talk about the definition of a microplastic. What are we talking about, and how do microplastics get into the water system?
So microplastics are any plastic particle that are less than 5 millimeters in their longest diameter. So you can have quite large microplastics like the plastic pellets that I was talking about. But you can also have very tiny microplastics that are micron size, so you can't actually see them with the naked eye. So most of what we do is we study microplastics under a microscope, right? And you wouldn't be able to see them, but we can see them if we're looking down the microscope. So these microplastic particles, they actually get into the lakes by traveling down the rivers or creeks. So tributaries are one of the main pathways to bring any of that material down to the lake. So in the case of pellets, for example, I've seen pellets floating down the Humber River, and I've seen pellets beached along the Humber Bay. So I know that pellets are floating down those rivers. The pellets are made in plastic industry. So they're the raw products that are used. They're melted down and molded into different plastic products. So like your ketchup bottle, for example. So these pellets can get into the system through spillage. They can spill within the factory itself, or they can spill when they are being transported. So the pellets are transported to other industry in which they would actually make the products. So there have been reports of pellet spills all over the world, actually. There was a big spill in 2008 into a river that flows into Lake Superior, and those pellets are still floating in the lake, and they're still being found on the shoreline. The tiny microplastics, so the fibers, for example, those come from textiles, things like carpets or your clothing, and they make their way down into the lake. Because these are so tiny, they don't actually get trapped in water treatment processes, so they make their way out to the lakes. There are also fragments, and these are tiny pieces that are just broken down from larger plastic products. We find a lot of things like paint chips or rubber, tiny pieces of rubber that may come from tire wear, for example. So there are many different sources and many different pathways. So some of them are light enough to be blown into the water, but others, they obviously travel down rivers. And when we have a storm event and the water rises, then you tend to take everything that's along those river banks and incorporate it into the water, and then it ends up into the lakes.
You also mentioned there are two types of plastic or two categories of plastic that you find. One is, as you say, floating on the top of the surface, and the other is sedimentary down on the lake bed. How do you find that plastic?
So the most plastics are less dense than water, so they tend to float, but we are still finding things like polyethylene and polyethylene, which are less dense than water. We find them on the lake bottom, and that there are different ways in which it can actually sink. So plastics often contain mineral fillers, and like kaolinite or clay minerals, and they will increase the density of the plastic. Or even in the water column, clay minerals that are floating will adsorb to the surfaces of the microplastic, and that will cause it to sink as well. So there are different ways that make it sink. And once it is down there, what we do is we actually go out and sample. We get some of our samples from the lakes from the Ministry of the, I'm trying to remember what it's called, the Ministry of the Environment, Conservation and Parks, and also from Environment and Climate Change Canada. So they go out and they collect cores, box core samples, and send them to us. And so we can analyze them. We separate out the sediment, natural sediment grains, from the microplastics using density liquids. When it comes to rivers, we actually go out and sample ourselves. We use what's called a petit ponar sampler. We go out in waders and we drop the sampler down onto the river bottom and grab some of that material and bring it back to the lab to analyze.
And let's talk about the word that's fascinated me, plastic agglomerate. Mm-hmm. What is that and how did that evolve?
Mm-hmm. So plastic agglomerate is a stone. I don't like to call it a rock because a rock is naturally occurring. It's a stone. Most people would look at it and say it's a rock, but it's actually a stone that is composed of plastic debris, natural sand grains, so beach sand grains, lithic fragments, some organic material like seeds and sticks, and all of it is agglutinated together, so glued together in a matrix of once molten plastic. So what that means is that at one point, people, in this case, went to the beach and lit a fire, and there was so much plastic on the beach that they couldn't help but melt some of that plastic. And when the plastic becomes molten, it actually takes all of this material and grabs it together, and it cools, and then you end up with this fragment, which is a new stone, and it's a stone that is made up of natural fragments, but it's also made up of anthropogenic fragments. So the original location was Kamilo Beach on the Big Island of Hawaii, but people from across the world have found other examples of plastic agglomerate. I have a colleague that was in Indonesia and saw people who were working for a resort actually burning plastic on the beach. There's a lot of plastic in Indonesia. And so their solution is to actually burn it, which is harmful to the environment. But that's what they do, and they end up with these plastic agglomerate chunks along the beach as well.
Now, you can't see me, but I'm wincing as you're saying those things. So plastic agglomerate is not a natural occurring thing. It's human-induced, and as you say, people set fires or they purposely mm-hmm. burn plastic, and then you've got these big chunks, stones or whatever. And then what happens? Do they float? Do they sink? A combination mm-hmm. of the two? Or?
Yep. So it depends on how much of the natural grains you've got agglutinated to the plastic, but in most cases, these fragments sink. So this is actually increasing the density of the plastic itself, which increases its potential to become buried and eventually become part of the rock record. So this is one way in which, you know, humans far, far into the future might actually be able to look at a road outcrop and see a horizon of plastic material in there and say, yep, that was the time when people were polluting the planet with plastic debris.
Hence my question as whether or not you're an anthropologist. Someone's going to find these.
Yes. And even if someone doesn't actually find them, if they do break down under diagenetic conditions, for example, you're still going to see the casts of where the plastic once was.
And people are going to think they're fossils and wonder what kind of strange animal this was.
Possibly, yes.
So, again, what got you into this field of science, and what do you see in the future? Do you see more research being done? Do you see this as a wake-up call for people to say, hey, this is the result of what we're doing to ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's our hope. I don't work in solidarity. I have a lot of people who work with me, and they include social scientists, arts and humanities researchers. Some of my best collaborators are actually visual artists. So they take this information that I find scientifically, and they somehow find a way to portray that plastic. So one of the things that they have done is include this plastic agglomerate in their exhibitions at museums. And this fall in 2020, we'll actually be having an exhibition based on not just plastic agglomerate, that's part of it, but plastic debris in the Great Lakes. And it's going to take place at the University of Toronto. So it's a culmination of what we've been seeing, and it's a way to look at something from a different pair of glasses, I guess you could say. So we've got scientists, we've got biologists, chemists, and earth scientists from the science side, but we've also got the visual artists and the arts and humanities researchers from the other side. So it's not a problem that will go away with just scientists trying to solve it, or just artists, or just social scientists. This is something that's truly collaborative.
You're hoping that by putting these things on display, people will react and say, this has got to stop.
Exactly. Yeah. The more people see it, the more they are aware that it's an issue.
And do you have a collection of these in a cupboard somewhere in the university?
I have a collection on my shelves. I'm looking at them right now. And every time someone comes into my office, they're very curious about these plastiglomerate because they certainly look very different from normal rocks. They look like rocks from sort of their shape and also how heavy they are, but if you look closely, you can see different plastic items in them. I have one that's a rock, basically a stone that contains a lighter. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you looking for more submissions?
More submissions of plastiglomerate?
Yeah, if people find them and they don't know what to do with it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I would love to. Yes, we would actually, our group would love that if people were to send them to us.
And if people want to find out more about your research and plastiglomerate, what can they do? Where can they go? A website or research papers? Where
yep.
can you point them?
Okay, so if they are interested in any of the work we're doing, they can always log into uwo.ca/earth, and on there you'll see a list, and they can just select people and faculty, and they'll be able to find me, Patricia Corcoran, right there, and I have an external link that they can go to and be able to see the publications that we have published and also some of the projects that we're working on.
Dr. Patricia Corcoran from the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Western Ontario in London, Canada. Thank you very much for joining us on Earth Matters. And let's hope that we wake up and realize that this is not the way we should be going.
Thank you, Lawson. I agree.
The World Economic Forum held its 50th session in Davos, Switzerland, January 21st to 24th. We bring you Greta Thunberg's speech from the session, Averting a Climate Apocalypse.
1 year ago, I came to Davos and told you that our house is on fire. I said I wanted you to panic. I've been warned that telling people to panic about the climate crisis is a very dangerous thing to do. But don't worry, it's fine. Trust me, I've done this before, and I can assure you it doesn't lead to anything. And for the record, when we children tell you to panic, we're not telling you to go on like before. We're not telling you to rely on technologies that don't even exist today at scale, and that science says perhaps never will. We are not telling you to keep talking about reaching net zero emissions or carbon neutrality by cheating and fiddling around with numbers. We're not telling you to offset your emissions by just paying someone else to plant trees in places like Africa, while at the same time, forests like the Amazon are being slaughtered at an infinitely higher rate. Planting trees is good, of course, but it's nowhere near enough of what is needed, and it cannot replace real mitigation and rewilding nature. And let's be clear, we don't need a low-carbon economy. We don't need to lower emissions. Our emissions have to stop if we are to have a chance to stay below the 1.5 degree target. And until we have the technologies that at scale can put our emissions to minus, then we must forget about net zero. We need real zero. Because distant net zero emission targets will mean absolutely nothing if we just continue to ignore the carbon dioxide budget that applies for today, not distant future dates. If high emissions continue like now, even for a few years, that remaining budget will soon be completely used up. The fact that the USA is leaving the Paris Accord seemed to outrage and worry everyone, and it should. But the fact that we are all about to fail the commitments you signed up for in the Paris Agreement doesn't seem to bother the people in power even the least. Any plan or policy of yours that doesn't include radical emission cuts at the source starting today is completely insufficient for meeting the 1.5 or well below 2-degree commitments of the Paris Agreement. And again, this is not about right or left. We couldn't care less about your party politics. From a sustainability perspective, the right, the left, as well as the center have all failed. No political ideology or economic structure has been able to tackle the climate and environmental emergency and create a cohesive and sustainable world. Because that world, in case you haven't noticed, is currently on fire. You say children shouldn't worry. You say, just leave this to us. We will fix this. We promise we won't let you down. Don't be so pessimistic. And then, nothing. Silence. Or something worse than silence. Empty words and promises which give the impression that sufficient action is being taken. All the solutions are obviously not available within today's societies, nor do we have the time to wait for new technological solutions to become available to start drastically reducing our emissions. So, of course, the transition isn't going to be easy. It will be hard, and unless we start facing this now, together with all cards on the table, we won't be able to solve this in time. In the days running up to the 50th anniversary of the World Economic Forum, I joined a group of climate activists demanding that you, the world's most powerful and influential business and political leaders, begin to take the action needed. We demand at this year's World Economic Forum participants from all companies, banks, institutions, and governments immediately halt all investments in fossil fuel exploration and extraction, immediately end all fossil fuel subsidies, and immediately and completely divest from fossil fuels. We don't want these things done by 2050, 2030, or even 2021. We want this done now. It may seem like we are asking for a lot, and you will, of course, say that we are naive. But this is just the very minimum amount of effort that is needed to start the rapid sustainable transition. So either you do this, or you're going to have to explain to your children why you are giving up on the 1.5 degree target. Giving up without even trying. Well, I'm here to tell you that, unlike you, my generation will not give up without a fight. The facts are clear, but they are still too uncomfortable for you to address. You just leave it because you think it's too depressing and people will give up. But people will not give up. You are the ones who are giving up. Last week, I met with Polish coal miners who lost their jobs because their mine was closed. And even they had not given up. On the contrary, they seem to understand the fact that we need to change more than you do. I wonder, what will you tell your children was the reason to fail and leave them facing a climate chaos that you knowingly brought upon them? That it seemed so bad for the economy that we decided to resign the idea of securing future living conditions without even trying? Our house is still on fire. Your inaction is fueling the flames by the hour. And we are telling you to act as if you loved your children above all else. Thank you.